Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, the Michelin-starred restaurants of Greater Los Angeles with Elena Shatkin joining us from LAist.com. And in the second hour, we'll have the release of the homeless population figures for Southern California. Matt Tinoco, KPCC reporter, will be with us for that. But first, we begin by comparing and contrasting the Democratic presidential candidates' climate change plans, fossil fuel control measures, whether they're cap and trade systems or whether they see a carbon tax as the vehicle or other forms of government regulation. With us to talk about the proposals that are out there from Axios, based in D.C., is Amy Harder, energy and climate change reporter for Axios. She also writes the weekly column Harder Line, focusing on climate change. Amy, good to have you with us. So we have Joe Biden with his plan that came out today. Earlier, there was, I think it was in the New York Times, a report from someone close to the Biden campaign saying his would be a more moderate approach. What you've been able to learn so far, how would you categorize what Biden's proposing?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, there was a report in Reuters that quoted a campaign aide saying that Biden's plan would be, quote, a middle ground on climate change, and that really created a firestorm of criticism across the liberal spectrum from everybody from Senator Bernie Sanders, another presidential candidate, of course, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, all criticized him, saying there's no such thing as a middle ground on climate change, given the urgency of the problem. So then fast forward to today with the release of the vice president, the former vice president's plan, and any sort of semblance of, quote, middle ground is gone from the proposal we see today. And he echoes a lot of the same rhetoric that we're seeing from others on the campaign trail and echoes of the Green New Deal, which has really taken Washington and, in particular, the Democratic Party by storm over the last 6 months.
So, was there speculation that Biden would try and sidestep the Green New Deal as opposed to going after it as unrealistic and then come out with something more moderate? And in contrast to that, does his proposal say anything about the Green New Deal?
His campaign says that he supports the aspirations of the Green New Deal, but he doesn't come out in black and white to say that he explicitly supports what's in it. And you're seeing that, in fact, across the spectrum from some of the candidates, of course, not all, and there's, you know, more than two dozen, so it's hard to sort of group them, generally speaking. But there's components of the Green New Deal that you're not seeing in hardly any of the Democratic presidential candidates' proposals, and those are the ones that are beyond energy and climate change, namely the federal jobs guarantee and universal health care and federal housing. Those are broader social programs that aren't directly connected to energy and climate change, and you're not seeing those in a lot of these proposals.
Joe Biden's plan, $1.7 trillion over 10 years to combat climate change, and it calls for cutting net emissions of greenhouse gases to zero by 2050. And what I've seen of the coverage, Amy, is that he proposes funding that by repealing the tax cuts that were passed by the previous Republican Congress. What's the funding gap, though, between what reinstating the higher taxes would be and what it would cost to reach net zero emissions by 2050?
Well, that's one of the many questions that I think some of the energy and more policy-oriented people will be having over the next year as we really kick into high gear with the campaign. I think this concern about how to pay for these really big policies is one of the biggest issues with all of these campaigns. I think it's easy to say that, you know, we have these goals. It's going to be very difficult to pay for it, and I think that's one of the biggest questions. I think in this case, whether or not the tax cuts being repealed, going toward that money, it depends on going toward the policy of net zero emissions by 2050. I think it depends on how exactly that's achieved. And I think, you know, almost all of these policies rely on Congress. And so, you know, we've seen what a Democratic president can do with climate change without congressional support, and that was President Obama's 8 years in the White House. So we're seeing a lot of these big aspirations, but it'll really depend on if both chambers are controlled by Democrats after the election. Then that will really be able to give the Democratic president, if there is one, a chance to act upon these goals.
We're talking with Axios's Amy Harder, energy and climate change reporter for the news site. Amy, which candidates have embraced a carbon tax, which, you know, would be a very heavy lift politically, of course, because of the effect on consumers? And which of them have embraced cap and trade as a way of getting to net zero emissions?
This is definitely a question that reporters, that people like me, love to ask. It's one that a lot of candidates are actually skirting for the moment, in part because, you know, carbon tax is a very politically charged term that doesn't have a ton of support across the spectrum. There are a few, however, that do support it. Pete Buttigieg has supported it. Senator Cory Booker has said he would support it. The Biden campaign confirmed to Axios that the legislation that Biden would call upon Congress to pass would include some sort of price mechanism, which is sort of a euphemism for carbon tax of some type or carbon price. And I think you're going to see a lot of this sort of dancing around some of the rhetoric in terms of how to actually reduce emissions, because there's not a lot of ways to do it. There's a carbon price, there's cap and trade, as you mentioned, and then the other one is basically by mandate. And that would be considered the least cost-effective from those being targeted, but they could be the most popular from a political perspective. So I think those types of details will be ones that candidates try to avoid for as long as they can, because they're just so politically tough.
And, Amy, do any of the candidates get into the specifics of cars? Because, of course, here in Southern California, where we see record numbers of, you know, car ownership and cars on the road, and even though all electric and hybrid vehicles do have a bigger market share, it's still, you know, tiny compared to the internal combustion cars. Have any of them got into the specifics of how they would deal with all of the gas-fueled cars on the road?
Biden's campaign includes, quote, rigorous new vehicle economy standards that would, according to the campaign, ultimately ensure 100% of light and medium sales are electric vehicles. But the campaign did not include a date on that. So, you know, saying that that's possible even by 2050 is very unlikely. But they do say sales as opposed to cars on the road. And, you know, the F-150 has been the most popular car, you know, vehicle sold in America for decades. And so to what extent trucks can become electric, I think, is a really big open question. And so I think for now you're really seeing the candidates focus on the electricity sector, because it is so much easier to make it cleaner. And the transportation sector will be a lot trickier. We've already seen that under Obama, and I anticipate that we'll see it again as sort of the second round of actions that any Democratic president would take, because it's so difficult.
Amy, I would anticipate this is going to be a significant part of the candidate debates coming up. And do you think it likely that we're going to see the candidates really pushing each other on this? Or is that fraught because once you get into the specifics and what the costs are, what consumers might have to pay, that's just politically dangerous territory to get into those specifics?
I think to answer that question, you want to divide it up, you know, primary and general. And so I think in the primary campaign, you will see a lot of criticism among the very crowded field to see who can have the most aggressive policies. You know, Democratic-based voters really do care about this issue. That's what the polling shows. And let's recall that occurred also in the last election. Hillary Clinton running against Bernie Sanders, she tacked quite far to the left during the primary, and then she kind of moved back to the center in the general. So what I'll be looking for is to what degree you see sort of a race to the left during the primary season, and then to what degree the nominee has to shift a little bit more to the center to appeal to those voters who, although they acknowledge climate change and think it's a problem, are also concerned about the cost it'll impose on them.
Amy Harder, thanks so much. Good to talk with you today. From the news site Axios, she writes the weekly Harder Line column focused on climate change. She's energy and climate change reporter for Axios. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation and hear a conservative perspective from Nick Loris at the Heritage Foundation. It's Air Talk on KPCC. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, Alina Shatkin of L.A. is with us to talk about the Michelin stars that have just come out for Southern California restaurants. These are perhaps the most coveted of all restaurant ratings, if not here in Southern California, then certainly internationally. We'll talk about that momentarily. But first, more discussion on the Democratic candidates' climate proposals, both Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden coming out with theirs. They join virtually every other candidate with some degree of proposal that's out there. With a conservative perspective from the Heritage Foundation, energy economist Nick Loris joining us from D.C. Nick, thank you for being with us again. We appreciate it. Your thoughts about sort of how these lay out the trade-offs that are entailed?
Yeah, to me, the biggest trade-offs are the high cost of the plan from a taxpayer expense. I mean, if you're talking about the federal government footing the bill for a lot of these clean energy spending activities, $170 billion a year or more, that's going to come from the taxpayers. And so that's going to not just harm current generations, but future generations as well. And the second big concern from my perspective is the higher energy costs and the negative ripple effects that will have throughout the economy. The reason that 80% of our energy needs come from conventional fuels that emit CO2 is that they're abundant and affordable. And if there's a transition away from those fuels that are forced by the federal government, that's going to exact significant costs on the American people. In fact, it was President Obama who said under his cap and trade plan that electricity rates would necessarily skyrocket to drive up energy costs that would reduce the use of electricity.
Fuel conservation, yeah. Nick, I wonder, though, about the costs that are embedded with fossil fuels, because, of course, there are costs that come from that. The projections for what, you know, warming of the climate is going to mean in mitigations for sea level rise and other things. So how do you factor what the immediate costs of implementing one of these plants might be versus the cost down the road for the climate change impact?
Yeah, that's a great question. And my other concern with these plans is that even if they're enacted, I don't think it changes the future of the climate around the planet. If you look at climate models in terms of reducing U.S. emissions down to zero, it would only abate warming a few tenths of a degree Celsius by the year 2100. So even if we enacted these plans, I think we'd be in the same position where we are when it comes to a warming planet and sea level rise and some of the cost impacts that we could see from future warming. So I think we should take more cost-effective, pragmatic steps, activities like adaptation that have proven to be very cost effective and also very good in terms of preventative, the damages that we can see from a changing climate, no matter what the cause is. I certainly think that fossil fuels should be responsible for the environmental consequences of their use and the externalities that they produce on societies, but to tease out fossil fuels and blame them for the changing climate is difficult to do when we don't know all the factors for what's driving the climate.
Certainly, so
activity and man-made emissions are playing a role, but they're not 100% to blame for a changing climate either.
So what I'm hearing you say is that we're still going to end up paying in the future because the climate's going to change anyway, and our ability in this country to limit it is not all that great. But wouldn't the U.S. – I mean, the idea is that if the U.S. – undertakes such extensive measures, that puts the pressure on the rest of the world to do similarly.
I'm not sure I think that the rest of the world will follow suit because right now their priority is accessing affordable, reliable energy, and they've shown a willingness to commit to building and providing their citizens with conventional sources of energy, coal, oil, and natural gas well into the future, no matter what the United States does. I do think that there are productive actions that policymakers and the federal government can take to drive innovation for carbon-free and emissions-free energy resources and to drive more energy innovation at our national labs, as well as look at some of the direct air capture technologies that can help mitigate CO2 emissions as well. But what we do here in the United States doesn't look like it's going to have much impact on what the rest of the world is going to do, especially developing countries like India and China, who are going to be responsible for a large share of current and future emissions.
Heritage Foundation energy economist Nick Loras joining us from D.C. Let me go back to Axios energy and climate change reporter Amy Harder. Amy, for the Democratic candidates, how would they likely respond to that idea that even if the U.S. went to net zero fossil fuel emissions, the impact would be minimal globally?
That's a pretty common argument from Republicans and industry officials and others who are not supportive of aggressive action on climate change. And from a purely technical perspective, it's entirely accurate that if the U.S. acted in isolation, it would not have an impact on the global temperature. And that's why this issue is so hard. It doesn't mean necessarily don't act because of that. It just gets at the issue that climate change has this collective action problem, that if all of us act in isolation, it wouldn't have an impact. I think it goes to this this point that America's leadership has a lot of influence on the global stage. And we saw that under President Obama. The U.S. put on a plan to reduce its emissions, and then it got China and India on board, in particular China. Now, China's commitment to the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement is pretty controversial because it actually allows them to continue emitting and increasing their emissions to at least 2030. But nonetheless, they were at the table, and actually China is leading the world on renewable energy, also a lot of other more polluting technologies. But they're positioned to be leaders on these technologies. And so they see it, China sees it as a geopolitical way to one-up America. And I think that's something that you saw, for example, in Biden's climate plan today. He talked about trying to beat China.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Amy, for joining us. Nick, thank you for being with us as well. Amy Harder of Axios, where she writes the Harderline Climate Change Weekly column, as well as a reporter on energy and climate change. And Nick Loras, energy economist for the Heritage Foundation. It's Air Talk on KPCC.